This is The Books Cafe on KBC English Service. The Books Cafe is a cutting-edge program in the world of literature where we talk to writers and explore contemporary literary issues. Today, Hainga Okwemba hosts two guests. First, Professor Arif Khudairi, a distinguished Egyptian scholar, author, poet, and philosopher. Professor Khudairi has published more than 15 poetry anthologies, 4 story collections, a novella, and 8 literal translations. Our second guest is Dr. Matunda Nyanchama, a Kenyan publisher based in Canada.
Chinua Achebe once told us that the writer should actually march ahead, right ahead of his community. What we normally say that writers are the conscience of their society. We admire Egypt so much because of its ancient history, but today Egypt is burning. What is the problem?
Well, as you said, writers always ahead of their societies, inspire, encourage them to move and to change. In fact, in Arab world, and particularly in Egypt, we have poets and writers who changed our society. Najib Mahfouz, for example, and also Fuad Najm, Salah Jaheen, and others. And unfortunately, the situation now in Egypt is a bit hard and difficult, but we really hopeful because we had to change our society, and we, the old generation, we couldn't have the courage to do this, but our new generation, the young people, men and women, they had the courage to do such a change, and it is a peaceful revolution, in fact, and I am hopeful that we, in a few times, maybe in a few months, we will have a peaceful and a very popular government.
Well, that's very interesting that you underscore that point, the role of the youngsters in that peaceful revolution. But of course, I read, because I have friends, as I told you, I visited Egypt sometimes back, and I have quite a number of friends. There has been that claim that that the deposed president Hosni Mubarak is still very influential and influencing some things behind the scene. Is that true, or what is really happening? What are the issues?
Well, as I said, the situation is really very critical and also unclear. But as you said, yes, it is still, because this regime, Mubarak regime, has been long time, 40 years or more, and they are very influential indeed. But the revolution is more powerful than them, and things will be finally fine.
Uh-huh. Thank you so much for giving us that background information. Of course, earlier on you were mentioning Naguib Mahfouz, the late Egyptian Nobel laureate. He actually won a prize for a Nobel Prize. Dr. Matunda, you are a Kenyan publisher who started a publishing firm in Canada. And in fact, you published one of the works of Professor Arif Khudairi. Why publish?
Why publish? Because we need to capture our ideas in our own view and ensure that we tell the stories as authentically as we can. We are Pan-African, we are global, and we try to look for those stories where they are. And when we communicated with Arif Khudairi, professor, we found his work, and especially the poetry on love, very, very interesting. And very interesting for a reason that we live in a world of materialism now. And if you look at the way the Western world, especially, which has a huge influence on us, it is a world of materialism. We found that refreshing, and we thought that we bring it to our readers. And we have been successful. We have had very good reviews of the book, and we are proud of the fact that he accepted to publish with us.
Uh-huh. So how did you two meet? How did you meet Professor Khudairi, for example?
One of our authors, Christoph Kemwa, attended a conference in South America with Professor Khudairi. And he made the introduction. And, you know, as time went by, our communication, and we had this beautiful poetry submitted to us, and we made the decision to publish it.
Uh-huh. Interesting. You know, before we actually talk about the poetry of Professor Arif Odairi, I also know that Professor is a scholar. He's a novelist, he's a critic. But I'm very much interested in his scholarly work. For example, when we say that you actually did a lot of research work in methodologies of translation and theories of translation. What do you mean when you say, I thought that translation is just translating?
Well, in fact, the first time I came to be involved in translation was in late 70s when I worked as a visiting professor in Hankook University for Foreign Studies in Seoul, South Korea. And I taught literary translation in the school, graduate school of translation in Hankook University for Foreign Studies. And I managed with my three Korean students to translate one of the Egyptian plays, The People of the Cave, into Korean. And also I worked in KBS as a part-time translator to the radio there, and started from then to translate also some poems and some anthologies from Korean into Arabic, particularly the poems of a famous Korean poet, Kim Soo-wol. And when I went to Malaysia, I also translated anthology entitled Manifestasi or Manifestation from Hassan Malaysia into Arabic. And when I went down to Brunei Darussalam, teaching in the University of Brunei, I also translated two more anthologies from Brunei literature, Harga Waktu, Value of Time, and Damai Dalam Sentuhan, which means the touch of peace. And I published the second translation in Egypt in 1993. And also I translated some anthologies from Persian, the work of the famous Pakistani poet Muhammad Iqbal. And in addition to this also, I translated many Bruneian fairy tales into Arabic, and they were published in Brunei Darussalam. In the meantime, I taught theory of translation in several universities in Malaysia, in Korea, and in Brunei Darussalam, and translated also one of my anthologies, Trees Leaves, into Arabic, as well as an anthology of American poet Jeremy Slickson into Arabic. So I try to write about the Arabic translation experience and to project their experience and their contribution to the theory of translation.
You know, Professor Odairi, you know, that is a whole world of scholarly work, translation. You must be a very prolific writer, because how do you balance that then with your creative work? But interestingly, you know, for our listeners, you know, this is, as we said earlier, this is the cutting edge literature program in the country on the national broadcaster KBC. When you talk of theories of translation and methodologies of translation as a discipline in our universities, what does that mean?
Well, in fact, the Western experience in the field of translation and also the theories of translation, the methodology of translation laid down by the Western scholars is widely known, but the readers, they don't know anything about or a little about the Western theories and the methods of translation. And we had, in fact, in the 3rd century, in the Abbasid dynasty, we had two methods of translations. One by Ibn al-Batriq, and the second by Hanin ibn Ishaq. Both translators adopted two different methods of translation. Ibn al-Batriq method of translation was exactly word for word translation, which was ineffective and unsuccessful. But the second Ibn Ishaq ibn Hanin method was sentence by sentence or sentence for sentence translation or meaning translation was very successful. And in the modern time, we had also other methods adopted by Ahmad Hassan Zayat in his translation of French poetry into Arabic, and others also. And I myself, in my rendering 8 anthologies from Korean, from Persian, from English, from Malay, I try to adopt also my own methods of translation, which I pointed out in my book published in Malaysia, Foreign Literature in Arabic, A Personal Experience. And we had also a series about translation. In the Abbasid period, several writers like Jahiz, a great and famous Arab writer, Bayroni, Jurjani, and others talked about the theory of translation. They even talk about, they differentiate between translation and creative writing. They talk about responsibility of a translator. They talked about translating poetry. And Jahiz said that poetry is untranslatable. And in the modern time also, we had writers who talked about how difficult or how hard is translation. Even Taha Hussein and Zayat said that translation is more difficult than writing.
Thank you, Professor Hodairi, for that whirlwind around the subject of translation. Dr. Matunda.
Yes.
You call Nsemia, the publishing firm that you founded in Canada, that pan-African and global. You see? And then you also say that you thought that it was necessary for Africans to capture their own stories in their own way and move away from publishers that are those foreign publishers. Very interesting. But of course, there's a debate. I was reading one of the latest issues of this Pan-African magazine it's called Kilimanjaro, edited by this professor of political science, Professor Kelo Chuli. And there's one essay there about written by Goretti, but the other name is very difficult. She's a Ugandan writer currently based in the UK. And she says how that exodus of writers from the continent going outside there in the Western world to publish, that when they make a name out there, that is when they feel that they can always come back to the continent. That publishing and writing in Africa, as it were, does not unleash the African True. Writers to the Western world.
True, and those are major constraints in the environment, in that I think our African societies, we have not given the appropriate level of attention and the appropriate level of respect and remuneration for our writers. I think we are at a stage where we probably do not as much value the ideas that we see, that we take for granted. And sometimes, as someone says, you need to step out of the forest to see the actual forest. You need to move away from the trees in order to see the forest. And I would say that there's been this question of why do you need to publish in the USA or in the UK or whatever in order to be recognized? Partly, it may be because you're out there, you're seeing things from afar, and you're having perspective. Secondly, in the Western world, ideas African can be fascinating because they're new. They're new, and somebody who, you know, like in the Western world, almost any folklore has been exhausted. Any background stories that you need for things have been exhausted. But in Africa and the rest of the developing world, it's really a gold mine, undiscovered. But because we have not really internalized and understood the value of those stories, of those aspects, we take them for granted. And our view is that we need to tell those stories, capture them, and in an authentic manner, in our voices, without filters or interpretation by others, because we don't write them, somebody's going to write them, and distort them, because they come with their own perspectives and their value judgment. So our view is this, that as Pan-Africans, we need to write our stories, regardless of where we are on the globe. We need to write them authentically as possible, using our expression, our language, our experiences, and as a contribution. And our urge to our local publishers, say, on the African continent and government, is to really entrench the idea of capturing our ideas, our stories. Because a society without new ideas will never grow. We are moving towards what's called a knowledge society in the future. Yes. And this knowledge society is going to, countries that attain that level, that state of being a knowledge society earlier, would be ahead in terms of income per capita and otherwise in the world. But where do we get these ideas that contribute to this knowledge? They are within us. They are here. So we need them documented, debated, challenged, and so that they can find application in our day-to-day development. Yeah.
Interesting. This is the Books Cafe on KBC English Service. The Books Cafe is a cutting-edge program in the world of literature where we talk to writers and explore contemporary literary issues. Today, we are privileged to have a visiting Egyptian writer, Egyptian poet, novelist, short story writer, playwright, critic, and translator, Professor Arif Hodairi. Joining us is our own Dr. Matunda Nyanchama, a Kenyan publisher, the founding publisher of Nsemia in Canada. The publishing firm is actually Pan-African. He publishes works from across the African continent and the African diaspora. Professor Hodairi, you know, you actually gave a very illuminating background, actually erecting those lampposts of what it is actually when you talk about methodologies of translation and theories of translation. But of course, one of the earlier works of literature that I encountered when I was still a very small boy, and I always still go back to that work, was this famous The Arabian Nights. Myron, that book, there's quite a lot of scholarly work that has been written about The Arabian Nights, but most of the stories that we read today were adapted by Arabs somewhere around in the 9th century. But the first written text, I'm told that it appeared sometimes in the 13th century. But of course, there are very many versions of that story. There are those ones that do not capture all the stories. Some stories are left out. There are those ones that capture all the stories, and even the translations, the language, as you put it, sometimes, because most of the early translators were actually French and British, and you see the variations in the way they capture that.
Yes.
But first, before we get into that, The Arabian Nights, is that the only great literature piece in ancient, what we call the Arabistic literature, that everybody must read, or there are other great works that are not known to non-Arabs.
Yeah. Yes, it is. It is, in fact, one of the great masterpieces in Arabic literature. But it is known as Arabian Nights, but they are not all Arab or Arabic stories, because they based also on Persian stories translated into Arabic, and also some Greek stories, some Hindi stories, but the whole stories, the whole books, were finalized and rewritten in Arabic in Egypt. So that's why it was known as Arabian Nights. And some of the stories even were not added to the 1001 Nights or Alf Lila wa Lila, except later in the 12th century or maybe later than that. But the translations were different. Antony Jolon, the first translation, French translation, Jolon was a great storyteller, and he had the liberty to change, to add, just to introduce such Eastern stories to the French audience. But in fact, it is a great literary work which influenced the world literature, and particularly the Western literature, the French, the Italian, the Spanish, and the others.
You know, Prof, you know, I still want us to go back to that, the Arabian Nights. You actually talk about the 1001 Nights, the Alf Lela U Lela.
Yes.
These stories, you know, it's boggling. They were told actually for 1001 nights what really happened. Because I'm told that each story was told one day.
It is not really. In fact, the title, Alf Lela wa Lela, it is not Arabic, originally Arabic. It is Turkish. Because we Arabs, when we say Alf, it means many. It is not actually 1001 nights or 1001 story. But the stories went to Turkey, and the Turkish give the title Alf Lela U Lela. In Turkish, they say Alf and Alf and one, that means many. So when I read Alf Lela U Lela many times, and in fact, my last reading of the book, which in Arabic over 2,000 pages, it was to write my novel, The Eighth Voyage in Sindbad, The Eighth Voyage of Sindbad. And the book, in fact, very inspiring. Every time you read it, in fact, I read it to write a story about a fascinating Shahrazad. But I ended up by writing a story of Sindbad, because I found Sindbad like me, traveling all around the world.
It's troubadour. You know, writers are troubadours. Actually, they travel around the world. But interesting there, one of the most outstanding facts, again, one of the most profound, fundamental facts about the stories, those 1001 stories or the Arabian Nights, is that they're actually stories that were told by a woman. Yes. What is the place of the woman in the Muslim or Arabic society?
This is a great question. In fact, the impression of the Western that Arab women and Eastern women are oppressed, undeveloped, and passive. But the fact is the opposite. Arab women, Eastern women, Muslim women are very powerful. In fact, Islam gave the woman, liberated woman. Prophet Muhammad says, in his tradition, Women are equal to man. They are brother of man, of men. They are the same. And give them many rights. One of them, they retain their names after their marriage. The woman has to consent before she get married to a man. In Arab world, and I'm sure in other Eastern countries, women get the same salary like man. In America, where I worked there, women, they have less salary than man. See? So that's why maybe also partially due to the Arabian Nights, which translated in a Western point of view and projected women as passive and just appreciated for their beauty. But in fact, Arabian Night itself, the frame story, Shahrazad and the King Shahryar, project Shahrazad as intellectual woman, woman who is talented, woman who read many books and history, just to persuade this king to change his cruel punishment and the killing of women. So she tried to attract him by telling fascinating stories. And she doesn't finish the story in one night. Sometimes the story takes a few nights just to keep him waiting and keep her alive.
Interesting. Maybe for our listeners, maybe I should just underscore that the Arabian Nights, the origin, as Professor Hudairi has told us, were actually stories told by this princess called Scheherazade. And the story behind it was that there were these two brothers who were both kings, but one was ruling in a different part of the world. So one day, one of the brothers invites his brother to go and visit him. And so he goes, and he was actually carrying this many present for his brother. But somewhere along the way, he remembers that he's forgotten some very important present that he wanted to give to the brother. So he goes back, and when he gets back to his home, he finds his wife with another man. And he's so disappointed that he now feels that all women, the women folk, are very bad. And so he decides that he's just going to kill them. Okay, so he starts killing women. So what he did actually was inviting one of these maidens or virgins, make love to her and then slaughter her. Make love with them and then slaughter them. So it went on for a very long time. So this queen, this princess, Scheherazade, was the one who stopped that menace by liberating the women with these stories that were so enchanting that the king actually forgot his bloodthirst and lust for women. Thank you so much, Professor Hudairi. Daktari, you know, you publish stories from across the African continent, and you say that, in fact, the other parts of the world, they have run out of stories because they have been, you know, they have been doing all these films and whatever. But Africa is still that place where everybody will now be moving, even the Western world, to come and do their films. They're already doing it, but you say that there are still a lot of material that needs to be captured. But let me get it from you as a publishing house. Do you only publish creative works? And of course, you did say that Professor Hudairi was introduced to you by one Kenyan writer whom they met at a writer's conference in Colombia, Southern America. How do you get writers to come to your publishing firm? Do they walk and knock to the office, or there's a process in which you get those manuscripts?
We have grown organically. I think in part because the works that we produce have stood for themselves. The stories that we put in the market have got good reviews, and that's how we have grown. Initially, it was more like word of mouth, but now what we have done is we are available on the internet mainly. Because we are global, manuscripts come to us electronically. And in many respects, we publish works that are referred to us, are recommended to us. We do creative works. We also do academic stuff. In fact, we have published research papers. We have published theses, masters and doctoral theses. We do a whole range of stuff. And in part, our interest is this, to publish what the writer intended. I know that in this market, a lot of my colleagues publish works mainly to say they want to fit the curriculum. So they will come to you as a writer and say, can you change the story? Can you shorten here? Can you change the language? But for us, our interest is really to have the writer speak in their voice. We are facilitators of their ideas, their stories to the market. And we want those stories to remain as authentic as they should be, without distortion. You said we are Pan-African. Yeah, we're Pan-African. There's a huge African diaspora in the USA, in the Caribbean, in Europe, and in several other countries. So our market is that global, not simply stories based on the continent, but also our African diaspora. One of our leading authors is Garfield Ellis from Jamaica, talking about the African experience going to the USA, a story that could be told by any immigrant into North America. So we take stories that pertain to us Africans in on the continent and in the diaspora, wherever we are. Yeah. So, regarding the issue of manuscripts and how writers get to us and the process, first of all, one of the things that we have to tell our people is that if you want to be published, you need to have a story to tell. And then we help you tell it. In terms of structure, in terms of language, in terms of articulation, to ensure that you truly communicate what you want. So we have had cases where people have powerful stories poorly articulated and go through the process to ensure that they are properly communicated. But we have also had stories that are very thin, very well articulated. In that respect, we say, go reinforce your story. And in that process, what we have come to understand is that there is a lot of potential creative talent across that has yet to be tapped. And my sense is that it will take a monumental kind of investment by publishers and also policy to really capture the breadth and depth of the stories that we come across. Yeah.
Interesting. So, listeners, you are hearing there Dr. Matunda Nyanchama, the founder of Nsemia, the Pan-African publishing firm that is based in Canada. They have an office in Nairobi. Maybe just before the program ends, Dr. Matunda would have told us where the offices are here in Nairobi. Very interesting. I would want Professor Hodairi to read from one of his poetry book that was published by the Kenyan publisher. It's called The Love Poems of Arif Hodairi. And then, Prof, before you underscore that poem that you are going to read for us, I would still want us, before we conclude that chapter on the Arabian Nights, you actually wrote, as you said earlier, you wrote the eighth voyage of Sinbad, this great sailor. But of course, that is a riff from what the Arabian Nights did, because in the Arabian Nights we have the seven voyages of Sinbad, and you wrote the eighth voyage. So you'll actually share with us what inspired you into doing that. And then you read one of your poems.
Yes, as I said earlier, I read the Arabian Nights in Arabic several times because I teach it in the university to my students, and it's really a fascinating piece of art. And once I read the book just to write a novel about this fascinating Shahrazad. But after I prepared some materials to write my novel, I end up with writing a novel about Sindbad, and I wanted to write a new adventure. I was thinking what Sindbad would do after his seventh voyage. I thought he wouldn't, a sailor like him, he wouldn't really like to spend the rest of his life just sailing and sitting in Basra. But the sea called him back, and he traveled and had a lot of adventures. But this time, he set out not for trade, not looking for gold, but looking for something to him and to us more precious than money. He was looking for love. And I thought Sindbad, in one of his voyages, the last one, the seventh, he met a girl and he fell in love with her, and he couldn't take her back to Basra. So he went looking for her, but he couldn't find her. And when he returned to Basra, he was on his ship and looking at all the gold and emeralds he brought with him. And he said to himself, "So what? This is nothing. I failed to find what I was looking for, the love." But when he reached home and gave a party, and his friends came to greet him, and a magician came, and the magician watered the deer with Sindbad, and the deer changed into his beautiful girlfriend.
you know that's why we actually always say that Professor Hudairi is the poet of the nocturne. I think that is the best point at which you are going to read from your poetry book, The Love Songs of Arif Hudairi.
First of all, I'm really very grateful to Dr. Matunda to publish my work in Canada. He did a very good job. In fact, I write most of my anthologies are in Arabic, 9 of them. I wrote 5 in English, and I have some more also to publish. I will read 2 poems. The first, which is already turned into a song in America, I love you. I love you, for your eyes make me love the seas, the rivers, and the skies, and dream about you all the time. I love you, for your lips make me love the roses, the flowers, and the tulips, and the fly in the sky as a drunken butterfly. I love you, for your smile makes me love the sun, the moon, and the stars, and wait for the dawn every day in the light. I love you, for you make me love the birds, the streams, and the trees, and swim in a river made of musk, of charm, and dream.
Excellent. You know, Professor Hudairi is the poet of the nocturne. He writes these love poems. But of course, when I was reading about that poetry book, I was told sometimes the love, you actually, they are very metaphysical, that you take from the tradition of those famous Arab writers and poets, that the appreciation of nature is actually, is in fact the appreciation of the creator, God himself. So if you could just underscore that poem, were you writing it for a woman, this beautiful woman, or you are writing for something more supernatural, the supernatural world?
I've been always asked this question, especially from critics and students who write about my works. And in fact, even Sufi poets like Ibn Arabi and Ibn al-Farid, al-Hallaj and others, in fact, they usually write their Sufi poems developed from the love of women to the love of the divine, the love of God. And in fact, some critics already pointed out this in my poetry. And some of the poems here also talk about this spiritual kind of God, of love, the love for God. And in fact, in my recent anthology, which I call The Flute and Other Prose Poems, is all about this kind of spiritual love.
You know, Professor Hudairi, you talk of the Sufi poets. Who are the Sufi poets? Maybe poets, if you could just explain.
Sufi poetry started in Arabic literature in the 2nd century by poets like Rabah al-Adawiyya, a famous Rabah al-Adawiyya, whose poems already translated in several languages, including English. And she says in one of her poems to Allah or to God, she says, "Uhibbuka hubbayni." حب الهوى وحبا لأنك أهل لذاك. It means, I love you, God, for two reasons. One, for the sake of love. And the second, because you deserve such love. And then Al-Hallaj, in the 4th century, developed his Sufi poems or religious poetry addressing or praying to the mighty God. And then in the 6th century of Al-Hijra, in the 12th century, there was a great poet in Egypt, his name Al-Busayri, who wrote a very important religious poems called Al-Burda, which it translated into many Muslim languages and even European languages also, French, English, Spanish, and also translated into Swahili. It is the Burda. And then in Andalusia, Ibn Arabi, the great poet philosopher, whose work, Al-Futuhat al-Makkiya, his Sufi poems, were inspired by Dante, the Italian poet, in writing his novel, Divine Comedy. And also in Egypt, after this, we had a great Sufi poet by the name of Ibn al-Farid, whose poetry all this kind of praying and love for Allah.
So, in other words, you are saying that the Sufi poets are those are religious poetry that are grounded in religion.
Yeah.
But one of the most important thing, again, you underscore there, you start by this poet in the 2nd century who was a female. Very interesting, because in the Western world, one of the most famous poets in Western civilization, Orpheus, whom we are told that in fact his poetry were, there were in them some secrets about pagan religion in those days. But you see, Orpheus, for example, he had a wife, this Eurydice. And when this wife dies, and then Orpheus goes to the underworld to challenge the gods, he almost defeated death because he actually was able to be given back his wife. But then he's told somewhere along the line that don't look back until you get to your home. But then he walks for a very long time. He does not hear even the footprints of his wife. So he's worried. So he looks back, and then the wife disappears. She vanishes from that. And so critics and feminists have come out very strongly that that story about Orpheus, the great, one of the greatest ancient writers in ancient, I mean in Western civilization, was very subjugating. He had actually subjugated the voice of the woman because she did not have her own voice. And even when you go back to the story of Homer and this lady Helen, the one who caused the whole Trojan War, and that, you know, the projection, the way women are projected. But here we have these Arab women who are coming out very strong, and you keep on going back to them, going back to them. Very interesting. I really wanted to underscore that. Daktari,
yes.
You know, poetry, as it were, is such a, you know, this is a question that I should have asked Professor Hudairi because he's a poet, but you as a publisher, I would really want to put it to you that, you know, poetry does not have, many people do not publish poetry because they say that the market, its market is very small, they don't read. Why do you find it necessary to invest, to take that risk of publishing poetry? What actually convinces you that this is a good piece of poetry that you can invest in?
In a lot of cases, we depend on our reviewers. But again, let's underscore the point of the writer. The writer who writes beautiful poetry about love, for example, from Arif Kodairi, or Chris Okemwa, who speaks about his childhood and, you know, growing up, and the challenges of capturing the moment. Or Njeri Wangari, who talks about urban life, urban rural dichotomy, you know. Or Amos Tabalia, who looks at how we, as an African society, are. Those are powerful ideas. If you simply looked at a piece of work purely because of the income it's going to be to generate, then a lot of works may never see the light of day. Our interest is really to say, here is a beautiful piece of work. Here it is a message. And then we publish it. The market will judge it. And it will find, over time, its appropriate time in which it will make its money. And I will tell you that we have some of the, and some that have not been published yet, beautiful works of poetry. I mean, your own work, piece of work we published is a landmark.
Smiles in Paphos.
That's right. So I'm saying this to our authors, that our sense and our approach is simply to say there's a powerful message. Beautiful poetry is beautiful poetry. Let's give it to the people. Let the market judge. Let's not be undue gatekeepers. And that's our approach to publishing.
This is the Books Cafe on KBC English Service. The Books Cafe is a cutting-edge program in the world of literature where we talk to writers and explore our contemporary literary issues. Today in our studios, we are privileged to have Egyptian poet, novelist, short story writer, a playwright, critic, and translator, Professor Arif Hudairi. And you also have our own Dr. Matunda Nyachama, the publisher who founded this Pan-African publishing firm in Canada. You know, Professor Hudairi, before he came to Nairobi, he wrote, when he was invited to come to this conference, he wrote a very interesting poem called Ode to Nairobi. I would read this as a poet, by just celebrating the poetry of a fellow poet. Nairobi, a pretty a sound houri that escaped from paradise, a soft a tulip of twilight
that comes from a deep, a sacred night, and a pearl of moonlight in the vast blue skies. We have come to listen to your songs, to learn how to become one body, one heart, one soul, how to grow blooms of hope, of justice and truth. May you remain a fountain of poetry, a land of goodness, and a river of affection that runs in your valley like your pure melted gold. Whoa.
Excellent.
this, Prof, this is very interesting. It reminds me, you know, early this year, I was involved in helping my colleagues at Pen International, this writers' organization, helping some two Kenyan writers to go to Italy for a residency program. And the way that residency program works is that the Italians in Venice thought that, you know, there's quite a lot that has been written. Of course, Shakespeare wrote about Italy and Venice and in most of his plays.
And this book, Layali Granata, Granada Nights,
yes,
written about the same.
Interesting. Yeah, so very interesting. But what the important thing about residency program was that they wanted these Kenyan writers to go and live in Venice for 1 month and then reflect on the experiences and write about it. Very interesting. Now, Prof, I would want you to read one poem, and then one poem, make a small statement about, just wrap up about literature, and just share with us those very wise words about, yeah, literature.
As he's searching for the poem, I would really like that once he goes back and reflects on his experience in Nairobi and Kenya, that he writes the same, and that Kainga one time would have an opportunity to read that poem on the Books Cafe in the future.
Thank you, Dr. Yeah, just one poem.
Okay. This poem about poems, the poems. These poems that I write for you, sweetheart, may look like the rays of the sun or the drops of the rain or the scent of the flowers. They may sound as they come out, as the waters spring out of the fountains, or the fruits fall down from the trees. Although they cause me so much pain, and because of them, I sleep not at night, and I shed so many tears. Yet, if they look as pure as dawn, as pretty as moon, it is because I write them for you. And because they take some of the magic of your eyes and the sweetness of your lips, and when I present them to you, I wish not for anything in return, for thinking, only thinking, that you might read them a day or at night makes a poet like me dance in joy all his life.
Excellent. Your, yeah, final words.
Yeah, so for my final words is to say that let's write our authentic stories, and when you are ready, let's get those stories to the world. We are found at Ufundi Plaza in Nairobi. Ufundi is at Jivanji Gardens and Moy Avenue. We are on the 5th floor. If you can't find us there, you can reach us on the internet, nzemia.com. Send us an email, info@nzemia.com. And get in touch with us. Look at some of the works we've published, critique those, and let's have a debate about where the world of literature goes in this country and on a Pan-African scale in terms of capturing our stories, capturing our ideas, and offering our contribution to the world.
That marks the end of the Books Cafe on KBC English Service. Today, Hainga Okwemba spoke to Professor Arif Khodairi, a distinguished Egyptian scholar, author, poet, and philosopher, and Dr. Matunda Nyanchama, a Kenyan publisher based in Canada. The producer of the program was Jared Ombui. A repeat of the Books Cafe program will be aired this Wednesday at 5:20 p.m. on KBC English Service.